Welcome back. This is The Change Show with Simon Phillips. And I just want to go now to our very special guest, Jeanette Beetham, FRSA. Jeanette and I both are fellows of the Royal Society of Arts, although I think it's called something even longer than that. But we're definitely both fellows of that organization, which means that we have a real interest in how our community develops, how our country, if you like, and continues to grow and expand and become as good as it can possibly be. So we both have that sort of interest in mind. So Jeanette, it's lovely to see. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you, Simon. Thank you very much for inviting me.
My pleasure. So come on, for the audience at home, tell us a little bit more about you. Just introduce yourself.
Okay, well, I'm the CEO of a company called Right Resources, very small, but it's about developing the right resources for a thriving and productive neurodiverse workforce. So that's really my main sort of mission. That is my mission. And I've been doing this type of work for about 16 years. But I come from a background very much about people development and about business, because I was a late starter. So being a mature student, it was an opportunity to actually start on a career path that meant something to me. I think my life journey, certainly up until that point, definitely influenced that. One of the early jobs I did after graduating was I was an outreach worker for the Prince's Trust and also then an area manager for the Prince's Trust, helping people overcome challenge, as it were. I've also been a business advisor, formerly with Business Link, but I don't want anyone to hold that against me, but I was predominantly a startup advisor. And then became one of the first social enterprise advisors in the UK and worked on a government-funded project. So I think you can see that it's people and it's business, but it's social impact that really is a big thing for me. And I'll stop talking there, but just one thing I will add to that, and I say about my life journey, and that's because I'm dyslexic, neurodivergent myself. And my early years in education and in the workplace were not as positive as they might have been. So that's makes me passionate about what I do.
Well, I'm going to come back to that in a second, but I've just realised how much you and I have in common. I thought it was the FRSA link, but actually, I'm just going back through your list now. So I've worked with the Prince's Trust, working with young people who are coming out of institutions and trying to re-engage in society. So I did some work there. One of my best friends when I moved to this part of the world, which is the south coast of England, is a lady called Laura McHarry, who used to work for Business Link and run the networks in this area. So, yeah, lots of dealings with Business Link over the years. And then you were talking about the work that you did with the government. And equally, I did some work with the government around flexible working and work-life balance and all that good stuff. So we've had a very similar career along the way.
How interesting. Oh, thanks for sharing that. Yeah, that is interesting. Great stuff.
Yeah. So anyway, this is not about me. This is all about you. So I'm intrigued. You said that your early career was quite a challenge because of potentially, I don't know if it was because of dyslexia and the neurodivergent situation you find yourself in. So tell me a little bit more about that and tell us about some of the challenges you had.
It's difficult to know where to start, really. But if I start with education first, I ended up at a school that was, it was a grammar school, but that was a big surprise. But I was like a fish out of water. I didn't know what I was doing there, quite honestly. And I mean, I grew up in a household of an extended household of a mixture of disabilities. And so I've always put all of my family's needs way ahead of mine. And I seem to be the one that was far more able and should be achieving than my family, and actually I wasn't achieving. And I, as I say, I didn't know why I was at this particular school. You know, we were, while they, people leaving that school were going to be doctors, they were going to be lawyers, and you know, and they didn't want you to leave without any qualifications. And I took my O-levels three times. I was the only person in a sixth form taking O-levels. So when you talk about low self-esteem, confidence issues, all of that, then that's really my sort of, you know, but I wanted to go to college. I wanted to go and I wanted to do art and I wanted to do design. But of course you need qualifications to get in.
Yeah.
And I started at a college, to do display design. And after 3 months, they looked at my record and said, but you've only got three O-levels. You need four to do this course. You need to do another course. And because that was it, nice. I left.
Yeah.
And I got a job as an office junior somewhere, just got any job. In our family, I needed to earn. You know, we weren't a privilege. It wasn't a privileged background, most definitely not. I got a job as an office junior. And then within 3 weeks, I was then offered the job as the export bookkeeper working with this global company and qualified as a bookkeeper. And I was progressing all the time. But it wasn't until I was qualified and everything else, but I couldn't remember what it was I had to do each month. And I couldn't do the filing. I couldn't put things into order. And I was struggling with all sorts of things. So I very much had imposter syndrome from the beginning. But I kept getting offered promotion, and then, but I would worry that I would be out of my depth with the people that I knew, so I would go and get another job, and then I would get a very good job, and then I would do well, and then they would offer me a promotion. The first job invited me back, so I went back, and I was toing and froing. So it wasn't that I couldn't do it, but actually I very much had imposter syndrome, and it was stressful. And in the end, it really took it had an impact on my mental health.
Okay.
But back then, I had no idea why I wasn't coping with all of these things. And yet people saw me. I was the proverbial swan, looking like I was coping and everything else. But underneath, the feet were paddling frantically. And eventually, it really, you know, it got to my mental health.
Right. So at what point did you realise, or did the people around you realise, that you had dyslexia and that was the cause of some of the challenges you had?
Oh, it was a long time. It was a long really? Time. I had my children and then I managed to get on a course for long-term unemployed people, and it was a great experience. Small local charity. I was one of the first people to do MVQs. Didn't have to do exams, you see. It was proving that you could do these things, and I moved forward that way. And it boosted my confidence. And again, I got a couple of jobs, good jobs, but then I thought, I'd really like to try my hand at art. So I went to college, then I managed to get a place at university based on my work and my art. I did a joint honours degree full time while having two small children, and uni wasn't nearby. So I was determined, but 3 months in, I couldn't do it. Right. The way they presented things to me, what I was expected to do, I was struggling and I was about to give up. And then I realised that I could develop some strategies for myself to help me cope. Mm. And then not only did my grades take off, but I started helping other students. Still not knowing I was dyslexic. And I managed to get a joint honours 2-1. I got a first in art, and I missed a joint honours, a joint first by 3 points. And they said, you can appeal that because you're so close. I said, no, I'm fine. I'm fine. I never thought I'd get a degree, let alone two subjects, everything else.
Yeah.
And it was not long after that I started to realise that it wasn't that I couldn't do it. I'm not less than, I'm just different. And then I started to, you know, explore and everything else. But the weirdest thing was that in the work that I was doing around being a business advisor, I worked in the Centre for Enterprise and Business Development at university first, then you know, developing my business sort of credentials, as it were, as well, and helping long-term unemployed graduates and small businesses, and linking them together on projects and things like that. And it was through my work with Social Enterprise eventually that I did some work for the British Dyslexia Association. And then everything just kind of dropped into place for me. And that was it, really. And I haven't looked back. And that was 17 years ago.
And how did that make you feel in the moment, if you like, when you discovered that you were dyslexic and that was the key, if you like, to some of the challenges that you'd had? How did that make you feel in that moment?
It's emotional. It's emotional. And I feel extremely privileged to get the opportunity to do the work that I do, because I understand how emotional it can be for people. Mm. Because how can you get to the age of 38 and not know, you know, not have a full understanding of you? Mm. You know, it's like having a jigsaw puzzle with some of the pieces missing. And then suddenly you've got this picture and you realise, well, that's why I struggled with, it's a crazy thing to say, but struggled with dinghy sailing. I didn't know my left from my right, my port from starboard. When you're sitting on the side of a dinghy, not facing forward, you're facing at the side, feeling nauseous, not knowing what you're doing, people giving you instructions in terminology that you're trying to have to convert from port starboard to left, right, and then not knowing your left and right. But then afterwards, going on and doing large boat sailing and realising, yes, I can sail. I've got my yacht master, I've got my day skipper, I've got all of that. But it was dinghy sailing that was a problem, and actually it was because of my processing. You know, you don't realise how it impacts you on day-to-day tasks. People have a tendency to think that it's about reading and writing. I'm literate because I was able to have my early years of literacy learning delivered in a way that was accessible to me.
Mm.
And I'm extremely grateful to one of my teachers. And I know that it was the care and attention that she gave. And I think it was because she was multilingual. She was from India.
Yeah.
I thought she was a princess. I mean, she'd sweep in beautiful sari. For me, she was magical because she spent time with me and my early years literacy. I can enjoy reading. I can enjoy reading a book. But if I read anything factual, it puts demands on my short-term memory and my working memory. I have to read, reread, all of that. So it's not that I'm not literate. There are common misconceptions that you know, somebody is less than. And we need to remove that stigma. Not just because of helping to untap potential for business, but also for the individual and their well-being, so that they can fulfill their potential. It's a win-win, definitely.
Definitely, yeah, I couldn't agree more. I've been exploring languages a little bit myself recently, and one of the things I read was that the more you can read stories in other languages, the quicker you'll develop the skill of speaking another language. And of course, there's nothing technical in reading a story. There's no rules to learn. There's no, you know, grammar and constructs that seem arbitrary when you're trying to get into a language. And so it's transformed my understanding and excitement about languages too, because I just couldn't get on with all the different cases and all the different contexts, if you like, that came with a very structured approach to languages, which is what I encountered in school. So I'm actually enjoying it now, because it's just listening and learning unstructured way.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? And I think a big part of that is the fact that we don't necessarily realize it, but when we're reading a story, if, for example, you're looking at, shall we say, a book, okay, and the layout is good for you and it's easy on the eye, and you're reading it and it paints a picture for you, you're emotionally engaged with it. What it's doing is it's drawing you through the story. So that's a big part of it. And what you're what's happening there is you're actually getting your emotive learning from it, and you're painting that picture as well. And it's helping you to remember where you were in the story as well. What happens with facts is you don't necessarily have those hooks and you don't have the draw, unless it's something you're really passionate about reading.
Mm.
And that's the difference. And that's why stories are so good for people with dyslexia to start reading, because quite often they're put off of reading because of workbooks at school. Whereas actually, if you can encourage them to get into a reading book that's easy on the eye, draws you through, emotionally engages, they'll realise that actually they can enjoy reading. And that's why when children are starting to read, if they're struggling, why picture books are so good and why cartoons are so good, because you get a quick win from it and it draws you through.
Yeah, magic. Now, this is the Chain Show. We're powered by the GC Index. Now, the audience, if they've been listening to a few of the earlier shows, they will have been tuning into some of those life experiences that you shared. And one of the things they might have noticed is the sheer diversity of things that you've dived into and enjoyed along the way, you know, from taking on a double degree to picking up sailing through, you know, just the sheer diversity of activities, all those different organizations that you've worked with. And they will probably be associating that with Game Changer. So I know you've done your GC Index. What are your proclivities?
Well, I'm a 9 Game Changer.
Okay.
And a 6 Strategist, which is really helpful in terms of me coming, you know, converting my ideas into what I do on a day-to-day basis. And I know in marketing speak, what do they say? Cherchez le créneau. Look for the gap. But actually, I knew where the gaps were. I wanted to use my sort of creative thinking to actually develop things to fit where there were gaps around neurodiversity and awareness of neurodiversity in workplaces. So yeah, when I did my GC Index, it was, wow, yeah, that's me. It was definitely there.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, after the break, I want to explore with you how you've used that understanding of where the gap is around this neurodiversity. And then you've built that up into a service that you're working with your clients. And I would like to explore that and understand it a bit better, because I think this is one of those areas that's so woefully misunderstood and underserviced. And yes, as you said, you've spotted a gap here. So let's explore that together after the break. So welcome back to The Chain Show with Simon Phillips and my very special guest, Jeanette Beetham. Before the break, Jeanette was telling us how much her own experience has driven a lot of the activity throughout her career. So once she found out that she was dyslexic and had a real understanding of the impact that has in business, that was the gap that she spotted. And so what we want to talk about next, Jeanette, is what are you doing in that gap? So you've set up this organization, Right Resources. Who are your targets, if you like? Who are you out there trying to support?
I don't actually target anybody. Mm-hmm. And I'm out there to support individuals and the employing organisation. So for a long time, I was working on behalf of the British Dyslexia Association. So I'd kind of white label for them, and they would, you know, I'd be self-employed. And I would go out and I would work in schools, colleges, universities, workplaces, delivering awareness training, working with teachers, working with parents. But workplace was always my passion. And certainly up until last year, I was the lead on the workplace needs assessor training for dyslexia and neurodivergent conditions. So training workplace needs assessors on behalf of the British Dyslexia Association. So I've been doing that right the way through. But I realised well, all the time as well, I've been doing workplace needs assessments as well, one-to-one strategy coaching with individuals, but also delivering training to organisations who approached me. So it was very much, you know, I've never really done a lot of actual marketing, as it were.
Yeah.
So I would do some things for the British Dyslexia Association, but a lot for myself.
Mm.
And all of it would be for me, you know, me doing it, as it were. And it's difficult to know where to start, but I'm the staff dyslexia and neurodivergent conditions consultant at Imperial College. And they asked me to put in place a process of support so that staff would know what support was available, how to access it, simple booking system, all of that. And I was delighted to be able to do that with sort of information sheets, a flowchart, how to, you know, for everyone to know how to access it. And I think that was really important. But you can have all of that in place, but if people don't feel safe, if they're worried about this impacting on their career and everything else, they probably are going to be reluctant to access that unless it's last resort, you know, right. If there's, you know, performance issues or something like that. But people were coming to talk to me informally, and I realised that without being boastful or anything, there needed to be more of me, that informal, impartial, knowledgeable person. And that's when I developed a programme called Dyslexia Champions. It's about dyslexia because dyslexia is the one that affects most people, or the majority, in terms of its effects, known to affect between 10 and 15% of the population, but also the literacy aspect. You know, we all need to be able to communicate. So it's a big one in terms of our work tasks. It's the one that's most likely to impact on day-to-day work tasks.
Yeah.
But we also cover neurodivergent conditions, so it's not purely dyslexia. And at that time, I thought, well, what do I call this program? Because neurodiversity is everybody. So you can't be a champion in that sense. But dyslexia is the one that most people have heard of. And, you know, if I'd called it neurodiversity champions, I probably would have been talking to an empty room, for example, at that stage, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I developed the program. We did an internal pilot at Imperial. It was very successful. And then afterwards, other organisations wanted to have people do their the same training. So at Imperial, these were impartial, knowledgeable signposters because they could signpost to the process of support. Great. We kind of put it all together and it was great. But these other people doing it from other organisations, when they came, part of their role is to signpost to the process of support. They were finding there is no process of support in our organisation. What do we do? So they knew what the generic process would be. So, for example, going to Access to Work, part of Department of Work and Pensions. But they were finding there was no pathway within their organisation. So then, having done the level 2 training, I then developed a level 4 training called Neurodiversity Aware. And that is for those people who are looking to put in place the information infrastructure within their organisation. So head of talent, head of HR, people like that. So you've got the kind of foot soldiers, dyslexia champions, people in networks, for example, so that, you know, a network isn't just a talking shop. It's something where they can really take positive action. The level 4 people sort of looking at the culture and the process. And then, of course, there was a gap in between. And that's the line managers, the supervisors, the trainers. Yeah. And then I developed a level 3, which is called neuro-inclusive practice. And that's really for the neuro-inclusive professional. So I'll stop talking there, Simon. Sorry, you asked me a question and it kind of flows. But I think it's important to see kind of where they started and why we've now got a level 2, a level 3 and a level 4, because they actually fit, there's a fit for different people within their organisation.
Yeah, no, I let you continue because that was a perfect description. Because I don't know as much as I would like to know about this space, and now I feel like I'm better informed, because I think that's what I love about the work that you're doing, because you're operating at all of the levels necessary to make the change happen. Whereas I think some organizations just go in at the top and they think, right, okay, now we're going to make change happen. Or they think, right, let's just empower everyone. But what does that actually mean? Is it just mean that they've got a tick in a box on a policy? So I love the fact that you are working at all of those levels. I think that's what's going to make it successful, and already is making it successful. So you've put these three things in place. If I was inside an organization without that infrastructure at the moment, what sort of challenges exist in organizations without those things in place, as far as you're aware?
Oh, it makes it, I've actually gone cold, because it strikes a chord with me, and I feel quite emotional about that, because people are contacting me all the time who are in that position where they don't know where to go, they're struggling. I'll give you an example of someone who contacted me the other day, and this was a social worker who'd actually reaching out for support and not been able to access it. And it's there's no process of support within their organisation. They've made an application to Access to Work, which is an initiative under Department of Work for Work and Pensions, which is great. It's a great scheme. But actually, there needs to be support within the organisation while you're going through that process. And there needs to be a joined up approach to that, because she's found herself at a situation where someone needs to agree to the Access to Work application, because they need to pay up front, and then the organisation needs to claim back from Access to Work, and it has got stuck on a funding issue.
Right.
Now, that individual, if we think about it from someone doing a social worker's role, we need to care for the carers, because they are doing such an important job, especially now with so many people struggling. It just makes me go cold to think that this person has been waiting for support for over 6 months. It's now, she's on the verge of actually going long-term sick because she can't cope. Mm. Now, we know that there's been a cost-benefit analysis done on providing reasonable adjustments. And providing reasonable adjustments for, and this particular person is dyslexic, but when we talk about neurodivergent conditions, what we're talking about is dyslexia, ADHD, dyspraxia, which is more commonly referred to as developmental coordination disorder now, autism spectrum, dyscalculia. We've also got others like developmental language disorder, but they're the main ones. Hopefully I haven't missed anybody out now, but otherwise they'll be coming down on me. We cover all of them in the training. So we are talking about 1 in 7 approximately of the population, so it's huge. Okay. Mm. So this individual, you know, really, really struggling. But as I say, cost benefit analysis, what we're really talking about here, if you think about the risk in terms of the important job a social worker does and getting it right, and how safe they feel to talk about the fact that they're struggling, you know, the chances are that she's had to actually stick her head above the parapet and say, I need help. And depending on the culture within that organisation, that may not be very comfortable, especially if they don't have a process of support. That's not comfortable at all. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, her casework is growing and growing and growing, and she's not able to do it. And then you look at the risk in terms of the client she's working with. I'll stop there, but I think, you know, that's one that's very raw at the moment to me, because I feel very emotional about it.
I agree. And we're very fortunate in the UK, I'm aware, of there's a lot of infrastructural support, if you like, emerging. It's not all there yet. And I know that, you know, there's still a lot of pioneering and campaigning to do to get everything in place. Nevertheless, there have been breakthroughs in recent years and a growing awareness of these issues. But I'm also conscious that in other parts of the world, and here at KLDR on Leadership Development Radio, we know that the audience is right across the world and growing at the moment. So I recognize we are quite fortunate here in the UK, but I think what's good about this is, through having this conversation, we're sharing insights that may be helpful elsewhere. So for example, your figure there of one in seven have one of these neurodiverse labels is really important, because that raises awareness of, if I look around me in the workplace, wherever I am in the world, I will be dealing with people who have one of these neurodiverse labels that we can potentially work with. Now, I'm conscious that I'm probably not using the right words here. So what would you call somebody with autism if we were thinking about they are just one of the categories that are in this space?
Well, we're saying neurodivergent conditions.
Right.
Terminology is changing all the time.
Yes.
I think when you talk about autism, because the word neurodiversity was first used by someone who was themselves on the autism spectrum, Judy Singer, an Australian social scientist, and her thesis was focusing on autism. It was adopted, really, the word neurodiversity was adopted by the autism community. And so there is, it's very much, for some people, that's very much part of their identity. But neurodiversity, the actual word, really, if you look to the word biodiversity, we're actually talking about every variation on the human planet. So neurodiversity actually means every brain is different. Okay, but then there are some that are more different than others. If we said biodiverse, we're talking everything, aren't we?
Yeah.
So if you said neurodiverse, and that's why every workplace, every workforce is neurodiverse, and in amongst there you will have people who have neurodivergent conditions.
Mm.
Okay.
In your experience, is there a gap between what companies and people at the top of companies, leaders inside organizations, is there a gap between what they're asking for in terms of support and what they actually need?
Yeah, I think there are organizations out there who are not realizing that there is such potential within their workforce, untapped potential, because people may well be keeping their heads down so as not to be noticed. I think that there is a tendency to say, well, we'll do an hour's neurodiversity training and then we've ticked the box.
Okay.
Okay. I mean, if we're talking neurodiversity, you could say there's neurodivergent conditions. Then you can say that there are people who have acquired characteristics. So it could be people who've had some kind of head trauma,
yep.
Stroke, some kind of maybe surgery that has affected how they process information. And you've got people who've got learning disabilities. So, and then we've got everyone else, but actually amongst everyone else, who amongst them are neurodivergent, yet are not struggling at the moment.
Right.
So you can't say, there's some people who are talking, there's a very much them and us situation. It's actually we, it's all of us. Because we don't know until we get into a situation whether we actually are neurodivergent at all. I'm working with, for example, professors, doctors who've got really to really sort of senior positions and are not coping, and they don't understand why they're not coping. And it's because they've gone through some kind of change. Mm-hmm. We've all gone through change recently because of the pandemic. But what happens, certainly with dyslexia, if I use that one, first of all, is that if we have challenges with our short-term memory and our working memory, any kind of change, learning new things, puts demands on our short-term memory and our working memory. So I just use it as that. Do you see what I mean?
Great.
So when people think, can you do an hour's awareness training? I can scratch the surface. I can give you a brief overview. But I can't do it justice. I think it has to be comprehensive. It has to be accurate, comprehensive, and it has to be useful. Because there's no point in doing that awareness training, and someone thinks, actually, I think that might be me, and then you're not providing the okay. So where does that person go now? What do they do? you know, because you've lifted the lid to something, and then they're going to not know what they can do about it. Yeah. And I think what we've talked about this in terms of the challenges people have. There are great strengths associated with this, and this is why it's so important. Big picture thinkers, creative thinkers, innovative. We're all individuals. Not everyone's going to be good at these things. For example, there's been this common misconception that people on the autism spectrum are all going to be good at IT. No, it's not. We're all individuals, but we won't be able to untap and unlock that potential unless we're in a neuro-inclusive workplace environment where people feel safe and where they feel able to seek support when they need to. So
I think you've hit the nail on the head, and the fact that there's one in seven in our communities with neurodivergent conditions means that they can't possibly all be creative or all be IT literate. You know, there will be a range. Again, there will be some that that's the last thing on their mind. It's actually, no, I just, you know, this condition ensures that I have a real focus on whatever it is. It's not always going to be the same. And I think the one size fits all, let's do a quick awareness session is, as you say, it's not really gonna fix much. In fact, probably all that does is ensures that more people are inside organizations with no pathways, with no ways of, you know, they've now got this understanding, but nothing to do with it. They can't do anything with that information other than take on some personal responsibility to be a little bit more educated around some of these things to try and just help the people in their vicinity. But they can't help them within the constructs of organizations without some pathways being put in place.
Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head then. It's very frustrating. And, you know, what they will likely do, I mean, we're talking about the Great Resignation, is people will seek somewhere where they do feel supported once they have this knowledge, this self-awareness. I just wanted to pick up, I just remembered, because one of the things about my processing is that I struggle with my short-term memory and working memory. Yeah, I've been on calls with Australia, mixed, you know, global audiences, you know, and yeah, you're right, it varies from country to country. But in the UK, we've got the Equality Act, which actually backs all of this up. That, you know, the other part of the Equality Act here in the UK is that we need to take an anticipatory approach. You know, so if someone is struggling, we need to anticipate that this might actually be associated with neurodivergent conditions. But how can you anticipate if you don't understand it?
Yeah.
So we have to do that. So there's an increasing number of legal cases coming through around this where either, adjustments haven't been put in completely, or they haven't been put in place in a timely manner. Right. So there's that. But yes, I'm working with people in, you know, across the globe, you know, on calls and whatever. And one thing that I would say is that on a day-to-day basis, I still do my coaching. I still do workplace needs assessments, because even though I'm delivering training programs, I really want to keep it real. Like the social worker that I mentioned, you know, I need to know what's happening out there, because I think it's so important to the increasing number of people with ADHD because of the pandemic and the fact that people are working from home with no clear cutoff between work and home and things like that, you know.
It's almost as if the conditions around the pandemic, the lockdowns and the dramatic cultural and community shifts, if you like, that we've all experienced, it's almost as if it's starting to reveal a lot more people with neurodivergent conditions, because previously it might have been disguised, or it might have become just the regular daily routine that they were in, might have been keeping the symptoms of those conditions, if you like, almost invisible. And actually some of those will be coming to the fore right now.
Yeah, very much so. And this is, you know, if people do want to retain that knowledge capital, you know, making sure that the workplace is neuro-inclusive is going to be of paramount significance now.
Brilliant. Jeanette, we're going to take another quick break. Thanks for that. That was really insightful and certainly has increased my knowledge and hopefully for the people at home as well. So we're going to have a quick break and we'll be back. I'm going to ask you some personal questions and see what's going on for you.
So, I might come back.
We'll be back after this quick break. So, welcome back. I've been laughing with Jeanette in the break there. We've got some interesting stuff to share with you in the next few minutes. So, Jeanette, one of the things that we do here on the Change Show is demonstrate to people, if you like, through our own stories, how they can deal with change in their own lives. And, you know, it could be a little tip, it could be an idea. But the way we access that is just by asking our guests, you know, tell us about a time in your life when there was some change going on and how did you get through it? So I know I sprung this on you a few minutes ago, but what have you got in mind? What thoughts have you got that might just be of interest and help people who are listening to this?
It's an interesting question, actually. And I've actually been made redundant 3 times in my working life. And the third time that I was made redundant, I decided, right, I didn't see it coming. I didn't see it coming in any of the other times. But this is the time, actually, I'm going to strike out on my own. I'm going to start my own business. So if anything goes wrong in future, I'll see it coming and it'll be down to me.
Yeah.
But what I did do is I found, I didn't find them. I already knew them. I had a good mentor.
Right.
Had a good mentor, and I've had 2 really good mentors, and I'm still very much in contact with both of them. One of them very business focused, very, very straight business focused. And I have, and more recently, I have another mentor actually, and I shouldn't forget him. He's been brilliant. And I think mentors, as long, you, somebody you feel comfortable with, someone who you know have had a good track record, but actually they've had the ups and downs as well.
Yeah.
Because they've learned from that, and what they can share with you can be invaluable. But of course, I believe it needs to be somebody that you can be open and honest with.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're missing an opportunity. And I learned about mentoring and the value of mentors when I was with Prince's Trust, actually, because I used to train when I was the area manager across all the programs. I used to train the mentors. And you find that mentors get involved for various reasons. Some people do it because it's excuse me saying this, but it was a bit of an old boys club.
Okay.
Some people got into it for that. Some people, significant, because they wanted to tell people they were a mentor for Prince's Trust. So probably people weren't very happy about me saying that. And then there were those people who had a genuine interest in the young people and felt that if they could put something back, they would. And that's the kind of mentor that I wanted. I wanted to learn from them about, yes, it can be tough, and how do you overcome that? So I had a mentor that was very much straight business focused, another one that was very much social enterprise and people and development. And then more recently, I met somebody who was very much about a very spiritual person. Mm. And he's been brilliant. I'm still in contact with all of them. So I would say that when I first decided to do this completely new, different thing, having a mentor, it was just so good. So that would be my. You've got to be somebody that you feel comfortable with.
Love that. I've always been a big fan of mentoring myself, because there is that spectrum, isn't it, between coaching and mentoring, and coaching is absolutely phenomenal, and the coach doesn't need to have expertise in your space. They are just helping you discover those things, aren't they? But the mentor, and it can be done in minutes, can't it, in a conversation. A mentor can just say, okay, interesting. Have you thought about this? Have you explored that area? And just a tiny tweak can make a massive difference. And that tweak makes a difference because of all of their years of experience.
And you know, sort of saying some of the pitfalls that they'd experienced as well. And acted as a sounding board. I think it's invaluable. I will be forever grateful to you, Mark, to Brian and to Margaret.
Fantastic. And I think that's the other dimension of mentoring as well, is all the people that I know who mentor always say they always learn something from each of their interactions with their mentees, because there is something, there's a dynamic there, which it can be generational, it can be different backgrounds, or it could be different circumstances in which the mentee is trying to operate. So I've got to work my way around, you know, how do I fit my understanding with this new situation? So it's definitely a two-way process.
Yeah, it can. Yeah, and so anyone listening who you know, who feels that they have something to share and they would like to do it, I would certainly explore it, because I've mentored people, and I, as you say, I've definitely benefited from that too.
Yeah, and also I think it takes away the concerns that somebody who's looking for a mentor may have. They may think, well, you know, I'm just sort of, it's a big ask and I'm not sure if anybody will want to do this and etc. But there's loads of people out there who would love to give back. And as I say, there is a benefit for them too, because they do learn something along the way.
Definitely.
Excellent. So Jeanette, the very last challenge for you, should you be willing to accept it, is to share a piece of inspirational music, because in my belief, music has that power to really transform the way we feel in the moment. What each of our guests is doing is sharing with the audience a track from their past that really transforms them in the moment. So what's yours?
Well, I'll mention one, but I'm not really sure what the lyrics are like, because I could be saying something that the lyrics are not very appropriate or suitable, but the song that always jumps into my head, that kind of transforms the way I feel as soon as I hear it, is Love Shack by the B-52s, because every time I hear it, I just have to kind of jump up and dance. It's one of those, and it takes me back to my children's school disco, and I probably really, really embarrassed them, because whenever that came on, I just had to dance. So it still has that, and it comes on, you know, if it comes on the radio or whatever else it comes on, I just have the big smile on my face and I'm jigging. So if the lyrics are inappropriate, I'll apologise now, but I'll have to say that one, I think.
I think we'll find they're probably okay, because it's on the radio all the time, isn't it? Excellent. Okay. So, Jeanette, thank you so much for sharing so many insights and your understanding and knowledge about all of these neurodivergent conditions, because I think I've learned a lot today, and hopefully the audience has as well. So thank you so much for that. What can people do if they want to find out more, and how can they get in touch with you? Is there anything you'd like to share?
Well, can contact me or on LinkedIn. Please, you know, link with me on LinkedIn. The website is rights-resources.org.uk, but it is being changed, so probably LinkedIn is probably the best way to contact me. If you want to email me, you can get my contact details off of LinkedIn. Perfect. I think that's it. It just try to streamline it as much as I can. But also, I mean, if you, it sounds a bit boastful, I don't mean it to sound boastful, but if you Google Jeanette Beatham, you'll find the website as well.
Excellent. And on behalf of those 1 in 7 in society, I just want to thank you for all the work you're doing, because, as I said, I think earlier in the show, there's so much that we need to do to catch up and ensure that, you know, our fellow citizens can have a full life as well in whatever they choose to do. And so the work you're doing is phenomenal. So thank you, Jeanette. That's been really a real pleasure and an honour to talk with you today.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you. I think what I would like to say is that it's too important to get wrong.
Yeah.
There's a lot of opportunities out there. What's not been discovered yet, because someone hasn't felt safe to be able to reach out for support, because we need people who think differently.
Yeah.
And nobody should be struggling in silence.
Brilliant. Thank you, Jeanette. That was The Change Show with Simon Phillips and my very special guest, Jeanette Beetham. Go out there, find out more, keep in touch, reach out to Jeanette. I'm sure your stories and your expertise and insights will be invaluable to her with all the work that she's doing as well. So I'll be back again next week. Have a very safe week and look after yourselves.